tune in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Hi, this is Pat Matheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO.
You started off, pass it to Blue. Blue, pass it to me. I'll welcome Will, and then we can do a casual catch-up, and we'll do the thing. Everyone feel good?
Let's do it. 3 years in, three season in, I ain't talking that time. We was stuck in the pen, all the work they kept, all the work put in. Got it out the mud, see the dirt on our hands. Pretty boy Poots had a dope ass plan. The recorder came in when Mike came
Mike
in.
Mike came in.
Phone with contraband. Now you not, but still convicted. Damn, they did our brother wrong. 12 on the yard and he walked that off. Now Jaja's when he walk it out. KB packed like my cousin house, but we ain't throwing hands, we talking it out. Bring your own blanket, we at grandma's house. It's Mike, it's Joe, it's Poots, it's me. We was out there yelling, free BG. It's Mike, it's Blue, it's Misfit Queens. Buddy in the cut, that's perfect scene. Tick, I got something to see. I didn't do it, so I preach in the street, still praising the hood. Like I didn't lose Queen Moon, Ben, and Billy too. When it comes to this life shit, but I'm cool. So every picture I'm throwing up twos.
Every picture I'm throwing up twos, right? What's happening? Misfit Adi, huh? It's another one with a special, huh? Photo shoot fresh, Blue. What's happening?
What's up, man? I don't know if we're beefing, Queez. I saw your last post. You're all ripped. You're like, I just got done with a workout. I was already feeling bad about that. I was kind of mad at you. You're all, you know. Just
hey, don't be mad, be motivated, brother. Don't be mad, be motivated. That's what I'm
saying. Yeah, but
for.
what got me mad was you're like, now I just worked out. Now I'm gonna go for a run. You know,
yeah.
It's like I thought you either run or you work out. You don't have to do both.
It's prison rules in effect.
Slow down on that.
I was sharp when I was in the pen, so I had to get back to that mentality to get back to where I was so that I could move forward. I had to go backwards, like, hold on, I'm out here slipping. You feel me? Like, everything was wrong. Everything was going wrong. So I had to break it down and go back to the basics. Prison rules in effect. Blue, I see you, though. Be motivated. Don't be mad, brother. We're going to do this together.
Maybe I'll never catch up. Maybe I'll give it a shot.
Time you at 5 a.m. Be ready.
Cool. Well, I'm doing all right. You know, life is a trip. The world is in chaos. But we keep on kind of floating along, and life is good in this moment. So, Mike, how you doing?
I feel that, man. I don't feel great. Life is definitely tough. But that being said, this project is in, at times, depending, a breath of fresh air. And of course, we're once again back celebrating and honoring our founder. And so while that also is mournful, we have a longstanding connection. Will Power is what I would say, but I don't even know how you're self-identifying right now. Will, welcome to the show. Tell us who you actually want to be. And thanks for joining us.
Yeah, man, I appreciate that, man. And Will Power, at Will, Goodwill. You know, people, they name me these names. You know what I'm saying?
God's will.
Right.
You're a poet.
Yeah, man. And, you know, so like, yeah, I'm honored to be here, man. Thank you, Queez, for reaching out. I remember Armand some time ago, he was telling me how you guys was in the lab and you guys was working. And I was so caught up with mentoring, you know, people with mental health and addictions. And it took a lot out of me. Right now, I'm currently on break.
Okay.
I'm actually going to look into some contracting, peer mentoring work. MacBo just opened up a new opportunity where you don't have to work for an organization.
Okay.
You can be signed as a certified recovery mentor, too. And what that does is that as long as whoever I come across, they have insurance, I can bill them through that way and I can be more independent because, you know, in this type of work, there's some organizations that have certain values and principles that I'm down with. And then there's other things that I've been seeing in my experience that I don't want nothing to do with like that. And I don't want to be playing over righteous, but social work is not a scenario or a situation where, for me, it's personal. When somebody's on drugs or mental health, that's personal to me, even though it is my work, but I take it very sincerely. And I just come across some situations where other people had the autonomy to not be, they're not me. I just don't, I don't move like that.
Like, well, you know, it's very important because we always speak on recovery. We speak on reforming. We speak on the importance of mentorship and brothership and fellowship, you know, is what you taught me. So I know how hard and how much you believe in the work you do. And it's beautiful, but I also know that it's way more deeper than the word work because it's the way you live. So what you did was turn the way you live into your livelihood, right? So for you to even speak on and say you see some things you don't like, I know that it really bothers you because you would have never even brought it to light, right? So please, for the listeners, tell us how you see it being ran and the things you do like, and then tell us an example of what you see that you really don't like. You don't have to say names if you don't want to. You don't have to, you know, we're not about blasting people and putting people down, but they depend on Tin Can Phone to tell the truth, especially when it comes to helping and mental health. This is super important. So with the places you've been in your experiences, tell us something that you do like in the way that you see change in the people that you're working with, because I see on social media, you always with somebody holding one of them awards. You always with somebody holding one of them joints. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, we got another success story. I see it consistently, but I never see, and the world never sees the things that, even for somebody like you, Will, to say you don't like it. Could you give us an example of that?
Yeah, so I'll speak in like a general way.
Yes, yeah.
So again, as a disclaimer, you know, social work, it takes a particular type of character and personality.
Okay.
Human beings are not simple. We're very complex and complicated, and then we come from many different facets of life.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
One thing is that when I go in and I do social work and I do mentoring, it's about a human experience and a human connection, right?
Okay.
And being that I've been through prison, being that I've been on the streets, but also too, I've had some successes on the other side. It's an honor for one human to sit down with another human to have just the simplest conversation. For example, yes. How you doing this morning? Man, I'm really struggling. I got some anger inside of me, et cetera. Well, what do you mean? What bothers you? Just taking the time, but you know, it's an old saying, it's not what you say, it's how you say it, right?
Yes.
It's not, yes. It's how you support another human being. Too many times I see it being ran like, I see it being ran like a business, right? Mm. Very, very business minded, you know, seeing people be nasty to other people, be rude, scoot them on their way, not acknowledge them. And I've had clients come up to me, right, and say, Will, I don't come up there because of this experience with X, Y, and Z. And now, I was in Multnomah County, then I got moved out to Washington County. When I got moved to Washington County to do some mentoring, a lot of my clients was like, man, when they was coming back to get some services and stuff like that, they was like, it didn't feel like open or receptive. It was just like, and so for me, it's like, this is a place where we support the vulnerable. This is a place where we support people that don't have the mental capabilities. There's some fracture in their personality that they can't even accomplish the simple little things, right?
Yes.
But what I know is people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Come on.
And so just that little support, that little genuineness, and just being there with them and just spark, because a lot of times this is how it goes. Get off the streets, get a job, get clean, get a job, get an apartment, but somehow just always revolves back around.
Yeah.
Get out of prison, don't use drugs, get a job, get a place, get in a relationship, but sometimes it revolves back around. And what I'm thinking is, I think the reason why it's like that is because we emphasize so much about trying to get them the external things to deal with an internal problem.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So, damn, thank you for that. And I would say this, though. The bar is set so low for the hood or the inner city, whatever, that not going back to prison is ultimately, like, once you reach that, it's like, it don't matter what you do from here. You've accomplished the whole thing by not going back. So, like, I don't know. It's like, I try to figure out, because it's a certain type to say, like, okay, prison was just a stage, you know? And then you go in there, you educate, you come home. it sounds like people relapse whenever they make it to that next stage that they never been to before. Okay, I'm out of prison now. Now I got like a lightweight, cool relationship and a job. I never had this before because I've been hustling. I don't know these different pressures. It's like on a video game, every new level got a new boss. And when the bar is set so low that I just don't have to go to jail, like, what do you mean I have to be a good boyfriend or a good, like, what do you mean I have to be a good, you know, it's like, I already accomplished this thing of not going back. So then it's like, okay, you'll get that. Now you got a spot. Now you're the man of a household. Now on your taxes, you put head of household. If you never really experienced that and you still don't have that inner, or you don't have fellowship around you that's going to keep you elevating, it's easy to fall back. You get what I'm saying? So it's like, it seemed like every time we reach a new level of like a success or a new height, it's like we shell up. And then the one thing we know when we nervous and scared is, I'll go back to what I know best type situation.
So this is the thing. So in recovery, right, the first level is putting down the drug or alcohol, right? But that's actually just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, yes.
Recovery really doesn't have anything to do with drugs or alcohol. That's the initiation.
What do you mean by that?
So there was a personality. There was a character that promulgated these actions and behaviors, right? And so recovery takes many forms. So, okay, why was I committing crime? That's a good question to ask. Then how did I come up? Was I learned in these ways?
Mm-hmm.
Was there poverty? Was there, you see what I'm saying? So in recovery, myself, the putting down part, that's one thing. That's one level. Now, how do I learn how to live and cope with life?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I hear some bad news I don't like. I might be going through a breakup with my son's mother. I might have lost a job. There might be a coworker at work, I don't like the way this is talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I can't go penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
But that, all I know is penitentiary thinking. All I know is how to just quit and run away. See, those details need to be recovered.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Is that healing the inner child?
That's a part of it. That's a part of it. It is. It just all depends on who the individual is. Because some people grew up with decent parents.
Yeah.
So they didn't really have us. And somewhere along the line, something happened.
So tell me this, when you get a new client, I don't really know the process of like how long before you get to know the client or any of that, but when you get a new client, so you have a sit down, I'm assuming you'll have a sit down with somebody. What are you looking at that's going to tell you your approach? Because every person is going to be different.
This thing for me, I don't even talk about no paperwork, no nothing.
Okay, boom, ooh, okay.
I sit down with them. I tell a little bit about myself. I have them tell a little bit about me. If it's in the morning, let's go get a Starbucks. It's on me. I got this. And when they are sharing with me or whatever, there's this thing called mirroring, right? And when they share me stuff, it's about, because this person, we don't know each other.
Yeah.
But we do know each other. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if you done been through trauma, if you done been through the penitentiary, you done had some successes as a youth, but then you got turned out by way of whatever. See, we do each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this ain't about me. This is about you. But I want, because some people, they'll open up a little bit. And then some people, you know, traumatized people pick up on energy real good.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
Because in the streets, you had to read. In the penitentiary, you had to read. If you grew up in violence, in a violent home, you had to read the home before you came in because you didn't know what you was going to get.
Come on. Talking there. Will, pause for 1 second. Mike, Blue, do y'all want to jump in? Get out. Get Will, anything?
I did. Yeah, I wanted to, I think, you know, when you were talking about treating it like a business, that is, you know, something that's come up on the show a lot, like, you know, how I was in the prison and what was going on and my choices. And essentially the founding of this show was, yeah, this is an art project or what. I mean, I think it's a podcast that happens to be a part of my artistic practice. But the reason I think that it survived is because it's not just a project to me, you know, it is. And I love what Quee said. He's like, yeah, it's not a job to you. It's your life. It's your lifestyle. And, you know, maybe it's why we're all connected. We kind of all treat our lives and our work that way. But yeah, I just really wanted to shine a light on that for the listeners, because, you know, we really talk about this in the show, you know, why is it all still messed up? Like, why isn't prison working? Like, what's going on? And it's because the practitioners essentially are treating it like a job, like a business. They're moving people through. They're doing the checks and balances. But when you're working in a human industry, and I think I'm even doing some reflecting and learning about my own shortcomings in this area. Yeah. And I think if you don't do that, you never can do this kind of work. But I really want to commend you in that and, you know, celebrate that you're in the field doing this work. And I think I heard about the program you're talking about. Well, I mean, to go back again one step and really commend that you're not taking work from anywhere. You're like, mm-hmm. I'm only going to do this if I can do it the right way. But I heard about that assisted program. I talked to someone who runs like a houseless youth facility, and they went through the training so they could support their staff who are doing this work better. And they were really impressed at the language and communication skills that the people who were learning or like getting the certification had because of all of the things that they had been through and the ways that they needed to communicate in order to get things done. Have you done the training yet? Are you on that path?
For the youth program?
For the thing that you can bill OHP directly as an individual. Oh.
It's Certified Recovery Mentor 2. Certified Recovery Mentor 1 is where you can only work at an organization. Certified Recovery Mentor 2 is when you can bill, you can contract. So mm-hmm. I got let go on purpose from my job November 30th. I purposely did some things. I was discontent, and I was discontent because, you know, there's a thing called Measure 110 that's around, and millions and millions and millions of dollars are being poured into organizations. And I'm not against money. I'm not against money because we need money. We live in America. In this particular scenario situation, I was disheartened because it seemed like the talk around the organization was focused primarily on money, as if when you go to Dawson Park, right, there's dope dealers. And the dope dealers have, in the subculture of the streets, called licks. And they got the dope form called licks so they can profit off the miseries of people that are broken and things like that. And so I felt that vibe deeply where I was at. And it wasn't about me profiting off of my clients without giving them genuine lived experience and human to human contact, not just get them through for the numbers, get the numbers so the numbers can see and they can reflect, we can get more money. And it just felt too dope dealerish for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I spoke on it. And sometimes when you speak on things, I was let go for gossiping.
Yeah.
Working here for 4 years, my termination was gossiping.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an inside job more than anything. But had that not happened, while I got let go, I was on the last day of my training for this independent contractor. So my higher power, whom I choose to identify as God, the stage was set. So it was time.
Mm-hmm.
Time to advance. And sometimes I've been told by people, sometimes God will do for you what you can't do for yourself. Come on. So these events happened and they unfolded exactly how they were supposed to. You know what I mean? And I feel good about it. I've been able to forgive myself for compromising on certain situations that I felt bad about because of the, you know, because I've been out for 3 years, 4 years, but I'm still trying to learn how to live on this side. I wasn't long-term out before I came to prison. I wasn't paying taxes and child support and car notes and rent.
I wasn't doing that.
So I was caught in between, okay, do this and do that and make some moves. And my spirit, I was convicted. I felt like I was prostituting sometimes.
Yeah.
For the love of money. Now, my thing is this. If money was a remedy for me pre-prison in my addiction, I wouldn't need all what I have right now.
Yeah.
Money is a tool. It's an energy. But I need purpose and genuine authenticity with myself and with other people.
That's
beautiful. I just wanted to add, it's like the social work you're talking about is the work that we talk about in terms of what you got to do to meet people where they're at all the time. And what I think we point back to Mike a lot of times as our friend that didn't do time but is there for us doing time with us, you know, he shows up, right?
And joint struggle.
Yeah, and speaks to us and chops up ideas or helps us to unpack trauma. And we do that for each other, right? Like we do that for each other, and everybody in this world pretty much carries some sort of trauma. Not everybody, most people carry some
sort
of trauma.
Not everybody.
You know, and recognizing, you know, shout out to Trauma Almost One, the clothing brand, hottest clothing brand to hit Portland streets from Queezati. But Misfit, I just think that that's so powerful. And I think recognizing that this is about being human to humans first. And then we think about like what one thing I think that prison relieved us of is like, if you were doing it just for money, you probably weren't doing it. You know, it's like we made $35 or $65 a month, right? So if you weren't getting something else out of that, if you weren't trying to figure out how you could like push yourself in a direction of change or improvement or whatever, right? Gaining a skill, then it wasn't going to serve you. And I think that having those times of scarcity and having those times of where you're working for next to nothing informed what I'm able to do now. Like, I don't have to work for a paycheck. Like, any paycheck is like immediately, you know, 1,000 times what you made in a month on the inside. So I think that's, I love that what you're doing. And I also think it's like what guys need. It's what humans need who are getting out, but it's what everybody needs. Like, let's like take the time to be with people, present with people and listening to people and figure out how to live, you know?
In reality, like, it's like really in reality.
And, you know, according to society standards, some of us that have been to prison, see, there's a lot of us that got caught, and then there's a lot of us that didn't get caught.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us, we got caught, and we got judged and measured by society. Mm-hmm. And some of us got thrown away or labeled. Mm-hmm. But you got some people that's in high positions that just got money and didn't get caught, and they got human experiences too. But it came back on us, the ones that, for myself, this work is passionate for me because I grew up, I was born in 1985 at the epidemic of the crack era. My family was taken away. I never really had a functioning family. I grew up in addiction. I grew up in the ghetto. I grew up in the mental health and the trauma impact of all of that. So now that I'm older, I don't have to exist out of that. I can work on myself and collaborate with somebody and exercise human qualities, not just survival and hustling for the next day qualities, or getting over on my brother or my sister because I'm trying to survive. I don't have to live out of that. I can be a human being. I can identify when I'm not feeling well. I don't have to pretend and act like I'm hard or everything is okay and stuff like that, and then go get the Hennessy or the blunt or whatever to make okay. I can be a human and accept and forgive myself, and I can heal. I can start to heal just by talking about it, and I can connect and collaborate and start a whole culture, a whole culture.
Hey, Will, you interact and you actually deal with like a lot of people coming home, especially in recovery. Do you, when you see people that you work with or might have been your clients fail, do you take it personal, or have you come to a place to learn, you know, like everybody isn't going to be able to just, because I promise you, I watched your journey, and I can't say from the beginning, but from when we met, man, it was such a beautiful time, because it's when I met Mike and Tin Can Phone was like not started, but all the people were together. Then, like, it was at this exact moment where my life kind of took that turn, you know, on the path that I'm on now. But I seen you, and like, me and you together still resisting on the yard, holding down any book that you decided would benefit the brothers that day, depending on how you was feeling. It was always crazy how, you know, whatever book you brought out really spoke to my soul, and probably something that was like going on within that reasonable amount of time. So it always blew my mind how the days you brought different books, it just, it resonated like, damn, why he bring this book out? Like, I ain't even talked to bro. But do you take it personal when your clients fail, or somebody you know are working with fail, or have you grew to a place to understand that?
So currently right now, I don't take it as personal. The work is always gonna be personal. There's a voicemail from Armand that I haven't erased yet, that I want, that he called me one late night, and I think he was trying to reach out, and I was going through my own mental health stuff, and that day it was over with. I didn't want to like put any more on me. I just kind of wanted to just chill out, and so, you know, and so the work is always going to be personal for me, because I believe, even when it's not. I mean, I don't want to not believe. I just believe we can.
Yeah,
I don't take it that personal as much. What I do is kind of like give grace and space, and keep leading by example, because ultimately people rarely listen to what you say, but people are always gonna watch what you do.
Come on. Yes, Lord. So I'm glad you brought up Armand. I'm glad you spoke on brother. You were, from saying the inside and out, you were the closest out of, you know, the people that we all know and everything. You were the closest. You was his mentor. The endless conversations for hours we had, you were a big part of those topics.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned, because I want to support. It sounds like you have a good disposition around this, but I want to affirm and support, you know, like, you can't really support someone when you are out of whack. So,
yes.
But I also got a late night call from Armand and answered it. and we talked, and he was, you know, not all there, but in some ways more there than other times. And I was like, look, man, you know, like, this is tough stuff, but, you know, hit me up tomorrow. And that was the last time we spoke. So, you know, I think he was reaching out. His girlfriend mentioned at his funeral that he gave her like a birthday card, and she felt like that was him saying goodbye. It might have been outside of everyone's control, but even, I mean, I'll pick up Queez's line of inquiry as well, but even, you know, I think that per Queez's original question, like, do you take it personal? I think you and I feel similar. Like, it is personal. And I remember when Buddy reached out to tell me, he was taking it real hard, and I was able to kind of support him. But I, at this point in this line of work, I just don't know how not to expect that it's coming, even when I don't want it to. But yeah, I think like this is a good time for, you know, listeners. I mean, you can take it any which way you want, but, you know, listen, you know, you were a part of, we talk about great American stories on this show all the time. At the beginning of this season, we had Armand on the show because he's kind of like on and off. And we talked about that project and how momentous it was in founding this enterprise that exists. And you were one of the interviewees, and you were even a major inspiration to do the project, because he was like, man, this guy Will is just always on the books. He's not for any of that nonsense at any point. And so you were Armand's guy. So yeah, tell us about your relationship to Armand, the founder of this show, and yeah, how you're handling his transition.
I'm still in disbelief, really, man. I'm in disbelief. And see, when I become close to somebody too, while doing this type of work or living how I live, it's hard for me to see somebody that I love destroy themselves. I mean, I have trauma deep inside of me that I'll literally go into a freeze. I don't even got the words. I don't know what to say, because I don't want to say something, because sometimes I can be so straightforward. I don't want to say something to see you hurt, because then that'll hurt me seeing you hurt. And so, man, me and Armand, man, we met in 2018 at Columbia River. We were on the same unit, and I was heavily involved in 12-step work. In the morning times, we'd have breakfast at like 5:30. We would go to breakfast at 5:30. By 6 o'clock, I would be at the table, and I would have my pen and paper out, and I would be answering certain questions out of the book, trying to probe and trying to gauge whatever they was asking me around and about my experiences with addiction. I started taking on Armand as a sponsee, which in the 12-step program is encouraged to get a sponsor. Somebody basically who's done the steps before, who has lived experience that can help you probe your mind and what happened to why you did what you did. And I would work with him, and, you know, I had grace for Armand because I knew that Armand was still relatively, I think he was still like in his 20s at the time. He's like 28, 29. So I understood that he's still relatively, you know, relatively young and kind of like just still like doing this thing. So we maintained contact out here, and there was just a thin line between him doing the right thing and knowing how great he was. But then that's just the version I got when we came together. Then there was the other Armand that still frequented certain people, certain space, because he was young still. I mean, how old was he when he died? Like 32, 33? So yeah, he was still coming into, and I knew that. So I had to maintain myself and my lifestyle, and then I tried what I could with him. What I knew was, once a person gets activated in whatever they using and whatever they doing, all bets are off. There's a spirit that comes along with that. It's hard to speak and for them to hear or anything. And, you know, I don't want to be preaching at nobody or sharing nothing about nothing when the time is not right anyway. I want to wait for them to say, man, I need help. Now, here's my opportunity to share my story. If you heard anything out of it, I can share with you what I did to address these issues. And so it was sad, man, because we became distant. I don't know. It was difficult because Armand would always tell me all the good things that were happening.
I
didn't even know that he was even up to any of this stuff. You know, I didn't know that he was doing all these things. I was doing his
Best Foods in Portland,
his podcast, and I thought he was staying straight, you know. And I would tell him, Armand, you know, try to get 3 meetings in this week. Let's try to go over some literature and read a little bit. Let's do a little bit more prayer. Trying to implement, it's important to build habits and a lifestyle, even if you're not all the way straight.
Yeah.
But if you keep on having these habits and lifestyle, they'll influence and they'll grow bigger, you know.
Yeah.
But again, he was young, And, you know, he still kind of had the world. He was getting success. Sometimes that could be a curse when, you know, you're looking at people that's under the bridge. You're going, well, I'm not like that. You're looking at people that's shooting. You're going, well, I'm not like that. You're looking at people who ain't got no job. You're saying, well, I'm not like that. So you're telling yourself, well, I ain't that bad. And then you're getting success with it too. And then it seemed like he had a pretty decent relationship, a working relationship with a young lady that he was with, and that she was good for him and she was supporting him and all. So there was just so many things, and I just never seen this coming, man. Maybe sometimes I was like, man, Armand, if you don't slow down, you might go back to prison because you're wilding out. But dying from a fentanyl overdose, you know, I never seen this coming. But the truth about it is that there's been like 10 people this year that I know that wasn't known fentanyl users. They just called themselves being under influence and wanted to try it, I guess. I don't know.
Nah, they not even wanting to try it, bro. It's coke, weed. It's in everything. It's literally in everything. So it's like, it's over. That's what I always say. And that's what I be trying to tell the homies back home in SAC too. I'm just like, it's cut up so much and made from so many different places. It's in everything. I don't even think it's a point where people are like, let me try the fentanyl. You could just be like, man, let me try this Danny bar. Let me try this. It's in everything. If you're not getting it literally prescribed from the doctor, it's in everything. That's why I tell the homies, stop. Like, and that's why me today, straight tree. I only smoke weed. No, I don't drink. I don't snort nothing. I ain't popping nothing. I'm not, no, nothing on nothing. I promise you. I can't, bruh. It's too scary. But yeah, but Michael, I think you and his granny are... Yeah, I think y'all both agreed that he was really good at compartmentalizing his friends or the people in his life. And yeah, as Will was talking, I'm just sitting here thinking, like, I could see that. But just knowing him a little deeper, like, I met Armand, like, downtown Portland a few times, just him, you know, and I'm just like, bro, I'm out here. It's been a couple times I've been out there on my own, you know, thing and just happened to, like, bro, pull up over here. And, like, he'd be over and he was drinking and stuff. But like I said, for me, it was always like, okay, as long as you're not doing Zans, you cool. And that wasn't good enough as a homie. Not saying that I don't feel responsible and I don't feel like, you know, I could have did anything because Armand was really going to do his own thing. But, like, I did take it more lightly. As long as you're drinking, it's cool type shit. Like, as long as you're not doing this thing, you're cool type shit. And I think, like... But he compartmentalized, Will. He would have never let you see. You would have never knew, like, you know, like, besides us, we're the only friends he know that's like us, you know? Like, buddy.
Well, he made a comment that he didn't want to let me down, so some things he kept hidden from me because he already knew that I was pretty consistent in how I was going to respond to it, what I was going to say towards it, and it was always going to revert back to, hey, man, you know, we can talk about it, but let's just go do a meeting and, like, the disease of addiction in mental health in that aspect is very cunning because especially for a functioning alcoholic or addict, you know, they call it Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. You could be really good at when you go to work, you know, you could put on this presentation, you could be really good at that in front of your family, they would never know. But then once you leave out of there and it's like 9 at night, 10 at night, you turn to Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, you know, you switch, man, and it's a big loss, man. It's a big loss, but what I've chosen to do is going forward is reach out more often to my loved ones, reach out more often to just friends and stuff, just to say, hey, man, how you doing? And it's just, there's so much work to do, man. There's so much out there to do, and some people are moving in this direction, and some of us are moving in that direction, and that's where my dilemma is at, right? It's like, I want to help out, but surely, though, I don't want to put myself in a position, if somebody's drowning, I don't want to hop up in the water and try to save them, and then they grab onto me, and then I'm drowned, you know? It's a double-edged sword, you know? What do I do? And I try to put him in prayer and pray with him over things. There was just a lot, you know, he would tell me about family stuff, you know, about coming from the Middle East, and father struggling with alcoholism, and mom, you know, doing her best with everything. Then his sister had a dilemma when she wanted to go reach for her dreams. That was real hard on him. And we did some work together around that with her. But he just, Armand, man, he had to be an adult, man, before he, you know what I mean? Like, even though his father is the father, his father didn't speak that much English. Father wasn't networking the American world. Armand came up in the American world and adapted to the American system and culture while still holding room for his roots. So, but he still had to be the translator for this. show up for that. He had to be like a father figure. You know, there was some stuff going on, from what I understand, with, you know, just some inside family stuff that was disheartening that he shared about. And he had a lot of pressure on him, and he was just a young man trying to figure it out. I think that the reason why we connected was because I played that big brother, and maybe to a certain extent, a fatherly role to him, to speak to him, to encourage him, you know? And it's sad, man. And I have not made peace. I have not went down to his grave to have a talk with him just yet, you know? Still trying to wrap my mind around, you know, I could have done more. I could have been there more. Yeah. And I could have tried a little harder. You know, sometimes you think like, hey, man, he's sharp. He's a sharp guy. Mm-hmm. He'll get it. You know, you think that. You go, he'll get it. And sometimes.
I mean, it's a fascinating, the limited capacity, like your work, right? It's like how you identify, it's your life. And so sometimes you just don't have any more gas in the tank. You know what I mean? And you even say that, like you didn't catch the call. But at that moment, and I was a similar situation, like I had a flight in the morning. I'm like, all right, man, like hit me up in the morning. But, you know, and a lot of folks mentioned that he talked to them within days. And so his whole community couldn't stop him. And as it came up, you know, he would compartmentalize. And it's interesting to be kind of in conversation with you, because I would say to him too, like, I mean, I don't know addictions. Like, I'm getting to know it through the work over time. But I was just like, look, man, like, I don't think you can use anything ever. I don't think that there's a limited version. Like, it's cool, I do some stuff sometimes, but I'm not navigating the same challenge and genealogically, ideologically, all of these different things, they are like a black hole for you. Like, you can't get out once you're in there. And my only understanding of that, like, some people can just turn it off and be cool, I guess, but like, you need a community and you need the meetings. And so, and you know, this is overlapping, but not the same thing, but I would tell all the guys, like, you need therapy. Like, there's, and just for everyone's awares and for all the different ways, like, I'm getting a new therapist right now. Like, I have my own work to be doing. And so, you know, I think that there is a reluctance, whether it's a masculine thing, whether it's a post-prison thing, whether it's a hard-headed thing, whether it's a male culture thing, there's such a reluctance to do the necessary steps. And I don't even identify as male necessarily, but I am embodied that or was socialized that way. And there's ways which my own kind of consciousness or neurodivergence has me push against that, but I'm actually suffering loss based on my inability to do that work right now. And in the face of that, I'm like, let's go to work. Like, where do I get a job? Give me 60 hours a week. But I think that, like you were saying before, Will, it's like when you get the success, when you get the job, you get the stuff, you're getting recognized in the American global way. Like, yeah, you can do some stuff. You can get the money. You can have the house. And then you get leisure time. And you do that any kind of way you want. And, you know, Armand was compartmentalizing, and you really hit it on the head. There's a cultural component of kind of trying to hide the concern. And when you kind of put it under the rug, your rug starts to kind of like lift up with all the dust that's under there. And so, you know, I think that is a part of the issue, and we can weave it back towards Armand as it makes sense. But what I also want to do is I want to mention on the show that Tin Can Phone and Blue and I specifically are working on this project called Mapping the Pipeline, which is about youth incarceration in some ways, but really looking at the different demographics and statistics around pre-identifying measures. And a lot of that's even housing stability and all that stuff that feed into people looking to substances or whatever. And so I'm going to do a little read just so for folks know. Policing Justice is at Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. It's a forthcoming exhibition, guest curated by Nina Amstutz and Cleo Davis. The extended George Floyd protests in 2020, which lasted longer in Portland than any other city in America, and were met with over 6,000 plus documented instances of police use of force serve as a point of departure to explore Portland's history of policing in relation to radical environmental and spatial juvenile justice. And so while Will is here and in our last moments, also kind of like support Quees in shaping this kind of inquiry, but yeah, in what ways, and feel free to also kind of like weave in, because I think Armand was a young man. Armand went in his early 20s, you know, and was navigating substance and lifestyle and all this stuff in his teens and early 20s. And then, you know, was lucky to kind of get suspended sentencing. But the way that policing of young people takes place essentially sets everyone up for this. So I'll kind of generally say, like, yeah, well, in what way, or yeah, in what ways does that show up for you? But Quees, you can follow up with additional inquiries as that.
I got you.
So as a youth, I remember the more so the policing was like by the security guards in my high school, primarily okay. aimed at more so like at the more like kids that were like more, because they didn't, you know, the Northwest is predominantly Caucasian, you know? And so okay. There's an imbalance in culture for a lot of African Americans here, because there's just not like a lot of culture for African Americans here. And what culture that was here, over here in the Northeast and North Portland, I mean, it's been gentrified. And now they're scattered, and there's just like a lot of stuff out there. So I just remember just when I was younger, just, you know, just always being asked certain questions, detention, et cetera. And, you know, looking back, I'm just a little guy, you know, probably acted out in certain ways because mom did what she can do. Dad wasn't there, but I was trying to get some form of attention.
Yeah. So,
being a little jokester or being like, but I mean, you know, just being like a young dude. I remember being downtown Portland in my 16, 17. That's when a lot of people would go down there and hang out, smoke weed, and
okay.
you know, stuff like that. And I remember the police, because, you know, we was dressed a certain way. They would pull up on us, ask us for our IDs. And, you know, man, all I got is a school ID. You know, I don't have, but they would make a culture out of it. And, you know, it was almost too, it was kind of like expected. If there yeah. wasn't any harassment, if there wasn't any type of, you know, because that's just what the obvious was, you know?
Okay, so, and from my understanding, Will, you didn't do no gangbanging, you didn't do any of that, so you didn't really involve in a lot of crowds like that. So how was it, and how did it feel to, because you was put and treated as the criminal without even looking like, hanging with, or engaging in any criminal activities, right? So when you say hanging out, it's not a bunch of pants sagging and—
No, just me and my buddies. We're just walking,
you know,
down.
Kids, you know, kids.
They'll pull up with the lights, woo, and you know, heart rate to go up. You know what yeah. I'm saying? A little piece of weed, sit there, be high, and they be asking us questions and what y'all doing down there, and you know. And then over time, it became like a norm.
So, do you feel it was a traumatization? Because for it's normalized trauma for you to get to a place where it's like, all right, they gonna with us. They gonna be honest. They gonna do this. Did you have anybody you can talk to at home, or anybody that you could go to for support dealing with these situations, or was it just like a hood thing where it's like, man, that's just something that happened? Like, how was that transitioning for you before you got to that place of it just gonna happen?
I mean, you know, it was almost expected. You know, sometimes being a kid, hearing about certain things that happened to unarmed people that were shot down and stuff like that. So coming up, it wasn't like, when they say we're here to protect and serve, the people where I came from, we didn't believe in that in the sense of with hope and cheer. That didn't apply to us. That's yeah. how we, because of what we saw and what was going on. So, and I never was necessarily told like the police or do something bad to the police. It was more so, uh-huh. Like one example is this, you know, when that George Floyd stuff started happening, I had just got out of prison. And the way how they kept on projecting on the news, white cop kills black man, mm-hmm. and then COVID was happening and everything was shut down, my PTSD kicked in to where I didn't have a car at the time. When I was riding my bike from watching the news and just everything going on, I was like, man, it's like a war. So what I would do is, I didn't have a job at the time. What I would do is, I would get those little construction vests.
Yeah.
I was riding to my grandfather, my grandmother's, or if I was riding to the store, if the police did see me, they would hopefully say, well, he's one of the guys that are working, so he's not a bother
yeah.
to me. And they wouldn't do anything to me. So that was a way of, like, kind of like got through just, you know, the PTSD.
That was
I was trying to outsmart them so they wouldn't, because I was yeah. kind of like, they knocking everybody off like that. Like,
so Will, at this time, you telling me that it really was a real fear to be a black man? Like, you were scared to get pulled over? Because I remember we have an episode we recorded. I don't remember which episode it is, and I said it in that moment. I'm like, bruh, never in my life have I really been scared. Like, I fear, like, because I just, like, I'm like, damn, they pull us over for nothing anyway. It's like, I don't care about a ticket. Like, I'm hoping that this ends in going to jail. Because at that time, brother, like, it you liable to get smoked. And it was a couple of them. It was a couple of people who actually got killed in Sacramento close to my family members' houses. You get what I'm saying? So for me to be like, damn, that's right by auntie house, like literally like right up the street. I was like, yeah. So you speak about your PTSD and your anxiety. That was the first time like I was really, really scared of the world. I was scared of the world. Like, cause I just knew like, man, if I get pulled over, man, like it's over, bro. Like that, it was, I never thought like, knew at that time if I got pulled over, it was over.
I was gonna say, as a young person though, the sad part in that part was that me and my friends, when we were treated like that, it kind of like drilled inside of our head that like maybe we are bad people. Maybe we are criminals, you know what I'm saying? Because that's how we've been treated. And so we kind of like carried that along to where it wasn't about being like being productive or doing something like good. It was like we started to internalize, wasn't shit, or we wasn't like, and it was like subconscious. And we kind of, we ran along with that narrative and can never psychologically overcome that narrative.
See, glad you said that. You agree when they say these things about us, we agree that we those things, and that's when that agreement attached, and that's when you start believing you are those things. So yeah, it's the four agreements, bro. You gotta be able to break that agreement in order to heal from that and learn that you are not that. But when the world tells you this thing and treat you as this thing, like you gone for sure. But and that's why when I speak on the bar being set low, it's like, you know, like these is reasons why I like the bar be so low. But go ahead and say what you was gonna say, Blue. I just wanted to acknowledge Will on that statement that he made.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I just wanted to identify like when people have the argument about like, is privilege real, right? You know, this is the stuff that identifies, you know, kids, children of color, you know, hanging out, or sometimes, you know, people who are not affluent, maybe it could be socioeconomic, but whatever kind of prejudice that it is, whatever somebody's bringing or society is bringing, that's, but it didn't happen in my neighborhood. I didn't have to worry about ever seeing a police car. I didn't ever have to worry about being hassled unless it was officer friendly. Like, I remember getting basketball cards, blazer cards, you know, one time or two times given out in my neighborhood from the cops. You know, it's like, okay, you know, like, thanks, now get out of here.
Right.
But it's like, that's a totally different reality and a totally different experience. And like you were speaking to, Quiz, like if you can start to believe if society tells you something long enough. And that's this like generational sort of stamp that's been put on things where people carry that through time, like because it's such a part of our society and the construct that we live in that it becomes just like, oh yeah, you know, like, you know, and we don't, it's, and it can be really obvious. I mean, especially if maybe a, you know, a mentor or a parent tells you, yeah, that's not normal. This is because of who you are and how they see you, right? That could change things.
Yeah.
But I think there's also this aspect, like, even if Malcolm Gladwell talked about how if you have to answer certain questions about race on a test before you take the test, that certain ethnic groups and racial groups will actually do worse on the test simply by having to acknowledge their race before they take it. That's crazy, right?
That's crazy.
It's this internalized thing that's been like projected onto people, and people can pretend like it's not real, but it's scientific, you know?
Scientific. And Blue, just to take it a step further from an epigenetic standpoint,
I love this. Do it.
You know what I mean? Like, it's in the blood sometimes, it's in the genes sometimes. That trauma, that fear, that scientific proof.
Yeah. You see what I'm
You know, they did an experiment, I think it was on three generations of rats, I forget the name of it, but the first generation went through some traumatizing stuff, and it was a smell associated with the trauma. Three generations now, they put that same smell with the rats that happened that trauma, and they started having reactions to it.
That's so just crazy. From
a genetic, you know, standpoint, like, it perpetuates itself, and You know, there's a book called The Body Keeps Score. You know, when I first got out of the prison, I was free. I was doing good. I was starting to do my thing. Somebody needed support. One of my recovering members, 12-step recovery brothers. They needed support. They was going for sentencing, stuff like that. And when I was walking through there, I had only been out for about a month. When I was walking through there, man, something happened to my body to where I was only in there for an hour, but just seeing that judge and seeing all this stuff, I had to go back home and take a nap for about 3 hours. And I was so discombobulated after the fact just because, man.
See, we got to think about this, too, with the generational curses. Our folks, you know, me and Mike, we often refer to the snake. But it's like our folks was teaching us how to deal with their trauma. Like the trauma thing and the traumatized things that they was going through, like they was teaching us how to survive that trauma growing up. You get what I'm saying? So if you come to a certain age, like even for me, like I was taught aggression. Daddies, uncles, brothers. Mom, like, bro, like when I was 2 or 3 years old, my mom used to, you feel me? She sold work and she used to, my sock was her profit money. My brother's sock was her re-up money and she kept her stones on her. I'm talking about 2 or 3 years old. You feel me? My uncle taking me to the block selling, you feel me? Getting crack out my diaper, selling crack. You feel me? Shit like that. Like, so, but they had to survive back then. This is the 90s. You feel me? 80s and 90s. They had to survive back then. I know though, I had to get to a certain stage where I'm like, hold on, bruh. Like this aggression isn't real. Like I don't need to be this thing because I never was taught other things. So when you get in a realm where people are emotionally educated or people are just educated in itself or people are, you know, you start feeling less than, and the one thing that you have is what? Aggression. So then you pull that out, mix that with being 2020, 2019, 2021, 2021. Like hyper aggression is selling. Hyper aggression, if you listen to us on the radio, you listen to, like, it's conditioning. That's why we have to pay attention to our, what we listen, what we allow to penetrate our, because that really matter. The music you listen to is going to set the tone for what you're doing, who you are. You feel what I'm saying? Like, I was grew up in a hardball lane, and I got praised for being such a gangster. I got praised for being so cold-hearted. I got praised for, you feel me, all of these things. But then I lose all my homies, and I lose all the people I love when I started being the right way, on the right way, because I had to shed. Some people arrested development. I know you remember you taught me that. Will, I know you remember you told me that arrested development. And that comes from not wanting to learn. You get what I'm saying? This is coming from when you get to a place where you know, like, all right, I understood they taught me this because it was this, but now I got to step into adulthood. I got to step into this, and you refuse to learn the tools, and you refuse to. That's like me still right now telling my little homies, like, yeah, load up and go ride on this. Right now, who I am today, that's like me telling my little homies this, knowing it's wrong. Yeah. You get what I'm saying? So, like, I don't know. I just, yeah, it's like,
I just wanted to jump in with just talking about, like, Will started off by saying he wanted to work for himself, you know, to not be held to these positions that are actually going to be counterproductive or not do the work in a way that makes sense. And it's like everything seems to be revolving around the ways that the system tries to perpetuate harm. And when you were talking, Queez, it just reminded me of how when I got out in 2018 and I had to go down every week to check in with my PO, right? And every week be abused by this person for real. Like for a year, this person like terrorized me. And I had a lot of trauma wrapped up in that Mead building, you know? And then the pandemic hit and they're like, oh, we don't need to see you, right? They didn't see me for a year or years, right? And we just would talk. And then after it ended, they're like, oh, now come back. I was like, why? You already proved that you don't need me to be there. Like, why do you want me to come to a place that just traumatizes me, that just re-traumatizes me? So I think it just feels like that stuff is all interrelated in these systems that just are trying to, like, break us down, you know?
Yeah, I'll give you a chance to respond. Well, I just want to say that we're getting to the end of our format, so we'll give you the final thought. Definitely have to have you back. I know folks got to, you know, we're in a narrow window and a busy time, so the holiday's coming up, but we'll have you back on the show, and we're going to do some interviews related to this larger project, and maybe we'll have you do an in-person event as part of this show. But yeah, feel free to finish your thought, Will.
I just want to, next time, know now this is important to me. Now, it's one thing to have external forces within the culture of humanness, but in particular African Americans. I want to discuss also, too, the way how the inner workings of African Americans own African Americans. You know, a lot of times I've associated with coach these specific programs, and they'll be, you know, discussing like about, you know, the white man or this, this, and that. And I'll go, right, you know, and I, you know, but what about how, whether we were taught this way or whatever, but the way how we, because Jews got treated a certain way from an outer enemy, so to speak, and then they pulled it together. The Chinese got treated a certain way from an outer enemy, and they pulled it together some way inside. So, yeah. I mean, just got to talk about it for myself.
You talking about that? You talking about that self-hate, though, that we be putting on each other?
I'm just saying, like, it's, you know, so that's a real thing. And so it's like, you know, but yeah, rest in peace to our mind. That guy, he allowed me to be a part of his life and his process. And, you know, while he would give me praises about how I inspired him, but really he inspired me in more than one way. Seeing Queez on his road defying the odds is inspiring me more than they would really ever truly know. You know what I'm saying? And so
yes, sir.
The rest of peace to Armand and, you know, Queez, Blue, you know, Mike. Keep it up, man. You know what I mean? Like, this can reach one person. This can reach one person, and it can shift something right here to where they need to get to the next level, you know, as a human being.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, we appreciate you, brother. We appreciate you, man. It brought back it brought back the memories, man, of doing them studies and that fellowship and the coffee shop conversations. And, you know, like, as I grow and as I on my journey, there's words from people that never left me, that never leave me. And, you know, you one of those people, because like I said, you came at an important time and you put it on me to be resilient. You put it on me to you know, misfit. Like I said, you, Ben, like y'all came at the same time, and, you know, Ben started calling me the misfit. And that's what it is now, because you told me I don't fit in with them dudes, and, you know, it could be a better. So, man, I'm glad to have you. You know, then we could call this a part one. It most definitely could be a part two. Man, you keep walking in your light, Will, because, like, you never know who's watching. They may not say they watching, but you never know who's watching and learning from you, brother. I appreciate you so much.
My love, man. I appreciate y'all.
Yeah. Yes, thanks, sir.
Thanks, Will.
Really appreciate it.
Bye, man. To meet again.
You were listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast, where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the sources. We tell the stories from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on Cable Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m. You can also check us out on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere you love to catch your podcast. And make sure to give us a follow over at 10canphonepodcast.com. And follow our Instagram at 10canphonepodcast. This Misfit Adi signing off. Hey.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
From applicant tracking systems to chatbots to facial recognition, artificial intelligence is transforming our world for the better and also for the worse. Tune in Thursdays at 9 a.m. for The Imaginary Possible, a show that looks at the captivating potentials and the troubling realities of artificial intelligence today. Only on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
I'm Mr. KBOO.FM. Them should know it's accurate. Kabaka Pyramid say watch your step, you know what I mean?
Welcome to Earth Riot Radio. I'm Reverend Billy here at